This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 441 for November 9th of 2018, Hyundai. And here we go. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
All right, everybody, welcome to Auto Line After Hours, especially you, Gary.
How you doing, John?
I'm doing pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
It's been a busy week, but I like busy.
Yeah, that's good. It's better than the alternative.
Every single time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, we got to let everybody know Greg Miglior from Autoblog is with us, and great to have you back on the set with us.
Glad to be here. Talking cars, it's November. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Let's go.
Seems like winter. Of course, it's supposed to snow tomorrow. He's getting out of here.
Beginning of the auto show season, it can't be better.
Yeah. And he is Mike O'Brien, the head of product planning for Hyundai Motor America, and great to have you back again.
Good to be here.
So we got to talk about Hyundai stuff. I'll tell you, out in the parking lot right now, I'm driving the Santa Fe. I'm pretty impressed by it. In fact, you put it on the cover of your magazine, Gary.
Right, yeah, it's a great car.
It's the package that's so good. I wouldn't say there's any one thing about it that I go, oh, my God, this is the best. It's the total package you guys seem to have gotten.
It's
a fourth generation, yeah. Mm. What's amazing about that product is that this is really a product where I'm not sure how the planets came into alignment, but here there was so much sweating of every detail, every little detail. So, you know, one thing a lot of the folks have talked about that have gotten in the car for the first time is little tiny things like there's an intricate pattern on the speaker grills that just sends a sense of, premiumness. It just feels very expensive. But yet the designers, when you talk to them, it's about some relationship to nature. And they had a reason. Everything has a reason. And it wasn't just the random picking of a material or a picking of a pattern or picking of a texture, but everything had a reason, and there was a lot more emphasis on synergy and thinking about how the thing would all fit together at the end and how people would imagine it. You know, people don't study things maybe in great detail, but they have a feeling about it. And I think when you get in that car, there's this feeling that the materials and the colors and the textures and patterns all just really communicate this sense of something much better than its class. It's kind of, you know, the old term class above. It feels very class above.
I just got a sense of the platform being very solid. I mean, that surprised me a lot. I mean, it just was, the class above. I mean, you think that this is more of a luxury structure than,
anybody could do this, but I think we have this advantage that we have. We're the only manufacturer with our own steel production. We make our own steel. And everybody can buy whatever steel you want if you spend enough time doing it. But we basically have about 400 engineers at our steel plant that are basically, in a layman's term, making different recipes. And so we can have so many different tailored versions of advanced high-strength steel for each component, each panel, that we can optimize, thickness and configuration and structure and also welding, whether it's laser welding or conventional spot welding. We can optimize all those things much more adept fashion. I mean, we can do it very quickly. We don't have to wait or negotiate because it's our own in-house supply. And so there's so many specialized applications in terms of the type of steel, the exact formulation and compounding to give that right combination of body strength and structure. And it gives a very, very rigid, the result is a very, very rigid structure. And then the use of aerospace that catalyze adhesives, it just gives it even a level up again in terms of NVH and body structure performance that our engineers have fought so hard. So as you know, we have 10 vehicles that either IIHS top safety pick or top safety pick plus. That's better than any other manufacturer. Retired with our sister Kia at 10, but the next manufacturer down is a substantial step down. And we all know as engineers and people in development at some time in our lives that that every decision is a trade-off decision. And in order to get all of those achievements in terms of body performance and energy management performance and safety performance, you have to do something. You have to either pay more or give up something. And to be able to do all those things together has been a real culmination of our engineering effort that really shows up in the Santa Fe more than any other product right now.
So you mentioned the number 10. And so you guys, in the last 12 months, have 10 new or facelifted vehicles. Okay, now that's almost turning over everything you guys have, isn't it?
You know, if you're when you're inside of an automotive manufacturer, whether it's us or another one, it's all about, in the end of the day, engineering throughput. So everybody has a fixed amount of resources. I have so many body engineers. I have so many electronics engineers, so many chassis and interior engineers, and so on. And so I can only do as many projects as my engineering capacity will allow. And when you think about the number of vehicles that we're launching right now, it just is really a testament to the throughput and the ability of our engineering staff in our facility here, in our facility in South Korea, our facility in Europe, that in terms of throughput, the amount of workload and the amount of projects that they could process to get all of those projects out in the course of one calendar year is really quite a testament in terms of a capability of our engineering organization.
You guys have a very aggressive product cadence coming up, 10. I mean, that's very, you know, very aggressive. But some of the competitors in the field have, you know, basically said, hey, cars, we're not going to do that anymore. But you guys remain committed to sedans. You know, what's your, why do that?
Well, think about it for a minute. So when you look at the units in operation of sedans, not everybody that's bought a Sonata or an Elantra or a Camry or a Accord, not everybody is unhappy with their product. Many of them will find the advantages of CUV and they'll move. And, of course, we see lots of evidence of that in the market today. But on the other hand, you look at the entire luxury category, for example, is smaller than midsize category.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Nobody's talking about abandoning luxury.
Right.
You know, we're all building more luxury cars. So there's plenty of volume left in the car category. The question is, you know, well, where will it stabilize? And it's actually an excellent question. When you look at some of the industry indices, we, you know, many people use the Power Information Network, for example, which is a daily report of what's transacting in our retail networks across the industry. And what you're seeing right now is a stabilization occurring. When you look at day supply, days to turn, percent of MSRP achieved by vehicle categories and vehicle types and nameplates, percent of incentives for versus MSRP. You know, 3 years ago, basically incentive levels for CUVs and SUVs were very low and pickups, and days of turn were very low, and percent of MSRP achieved in transaction price was very high. And, of course, the opposite was happening in the car categories.
Right.
You know, there were high incentives, high days to turn, and so on. But now when you look at that same data, you're seeing the numbers emerging. The day supply are equal, almost equal. Days to turn almost equal. The percent of MSRP achieved in transaction price nearing the same. And so now what you're seeing, all these indices are basically pointing in the direction that we're starting to reach a level of stabilization in terms of the car category products relative to the truck category products. Not to say there's more shift that's going to occur.
Sure.
Part of it's manufacturers adjusting their production schedules to accommodate a lower car market. And part of it is just the market is now starting to stabilize. A little bit of both.
So with stabilization, does this mean then that there continues to be opportunities for those of you who remain providing sedans to the market?
Well, again, you know, we were looking at categories that, you know, a few years ago were one and two, and now they're three or four. So they're still, they're not dead by any means.
Yeah.
And so the opportunity is for the manufacturers that remain that to, you know, identify what are customers that continue to want a sedan, what do they prioritize? And, of course, there's kind of two schools of thought from a planning community perspective. One school would be, well, let's make our sedans have more of the attributes of sport utility vehicles. Let's raise them up or, you know, have them put all-wheel drive in them and then make them work off-road and so kind of chase to the center point in the market. Another school of thought might be of what are the basic architectures of various categories optimize? Of course, CUVs optimize kind of go anywhere capability and inclement weather capability. You know, they have that sense of durability that goes along with them because they have those big wheels and tires and big wheelhouse opening, so they kind of feel like they're going to be tougher, even if it's just a parking lot at the shopping center. And on the other hand, the low center of gravity of a car basically offers the opportunity to have something that dynamically is superior. So, you know, some customers are going to prioritize that in the future. And for those customers, how do you, if you decide to go that way, how do you optimize the car category products to do what the basic architecture of the car does better? And how do you optimize the truck category products so they optimize based on their architecture? And I think, you know, that's the kind of direction we think that we'd like to go in, is try and find those areas where the car category products will do better. You know, if you look at a good example, we just launched the Veloster N. And the Veloster N is a high-performance car that has the track capability, but yet you could drive it every day back and forth to work. We could have more easily and more inexpensively and more quickly sold the i30N that we sell in the U.S. market as an Elantra GT. But you look at the center of mass, you look at the turn, you know, all the basic metrics of the body in white tell you the Veloster is a better starting point. And even though a lot of people would say, well, why don't you just go after the hot hatch, which is where everybody's comfortable, but we went after where the body would actually contribute to a better overall vehicle dynamics.
So for those who are not familiar with it, so the i30 is a very...
It's our Elantra GT sold
right,
in Europe.
And it's in Europe. And so then you have this new...
Which is like a GTI or a, you know, another one of the hot hatches.
So it's a four-door hatch. So you guys have launched the new N. So tell us about what N is.
So N is going to be a sub-brand, and it's going to attack one of the last key challenge areas for our brand. You know, we're well known for very rational and practical things, but guess what? People don't pay a premium for rational and practical.
Right.
They pay a premium for emotion. So if you're buying some luxury product, you're not buying that product necessarily because it offers that much more than the common market product. It's because the brand makes you feel good. You know, there's something emotional about the brand, and you're willing to pay a premium for it, whether it's a handbag or a car. And so that's an area where we have a lot of opportunity to develop further. And so we're looking at the N brand as our way to express emotion and the kind of driver engagement and satisfaction that our core brand, Hyundai, is not as well known for, and use the N products and the N sub-brand as a way to kind of raise our street cred in this area of the market where, you know, we just haven't advanced as much as our competitors.
So Hyundai had hired Albert Biermann, who was with BMW.
As I understand it, there are two chief engineers at BMW M, one over powertrain development, another over chassis development. And Albert Biermann was over the chassis side of BMW M, and a truly wonderful man. He's a great guy just to have a beer with and just chat. I mean, he started from the very bottom. He was racing cars out of his backyard. He said, you know, they didn't have a driveway, so he had to work in the mud. And I think, if I remember, he was telling me he was racing a Simca when he was very young, before he was 20.
Wow.
So he started out at the very bottom of racing. He worked his way up. He worked his way up through in the BMW engineering organization. And so he knows what he's talking about at every level. So when engineers engage with him, he knows that he's been there. And so he has a really dedicated engineering group that worked for him in Namyang. And he's really settled in on some really important themes. One, that if the car doesn't make you smile, or he used grin.
Looks like here's a picture of him in back by the car. Is that him?
If the car doesn't make you smile, you're not there yet. And so he's really focused on a driver that's so happy when they drive the car that it does something that was unexpected. And so he's really focused on what he calls the grin component, but he's also focused on performance that's achievable by an average driver. So we all know about performance cars that the first 70% we could all get to, but that last 30%, that's when you really need to be a good driver to safely extrapolate or safely achieve that level of performance that the vehicle is capable of delivering. And his feeling is that, no, our car, you should be able to achieve 95% of its potential with an average driver. And so that's really the special ingredient, I think, the secret ingredient of the Veloster N and future N models that will come, is that an average driver could drive this car and feel that kind of capability without having to go to a lot of extra training and skill level.
So does that mean you're going to tune the chassis a certain way, or the engines will be calibrated a certain way? How do you, you know, make a Veloster that's like for the everyman enthusiast?
That is a great question. And so I could just speak. I've watched Albert speak so many times about it. Yeah. And we've worked with him so closely in the tuning because there's been debates on the tuning. But for him, I think one of the most remarkable achievements of VelociRN that expresses your answer is how neutral an FF car can be.
Okay.
Nobody would ever expect a car that's an FF architecture.
FF being
neutral,
front engine, front wheel drive.
Yes. And so you expect the car to plow. You expect the car to have understeer. You don't expect the car to be flat. And the whole basis of HMI, human machine interface, is the driver, the operator, has a command in his head. How do you translate that command into something that's what the driver expected? So when you have oversteer and understeer, it's a way of basically expressing that the car didn't do what I wanted. I did this, and the car didn't do that. And so Albert's all about making sure the car does what the driver expected it to do. So neutral, the quick answer to your question for the chassis is neutrality. Okay. How do you make the car perform in the most neutral manner? An engine, he focused a lot on mapping, so throttle inputs would deliver the kind of pavement torque that the driver expected without hesitation. So he was very focused on a tuning map and overall calibration of the turbo system, spark, and fuel to deliver, you know, when the customer, the driver, pressed on the throttle, that the reaction of the powertrain was what the driver expected. Mm-hmm. No lag, not peaky. So he wanted a very flat torque curve. So the driver got what they expected they were going to get when they pushed into the throttle.
I would imagine, too, that it would involve giving the driver plenty of warning that he or she is getting to the limit. Because I'm sure you've been in high-performance cars that when they go, boy, they just snap and they're gone.
Right, and that's the target of having very neutral chassis, is so there isn't a snap oversteer condition or, you know, a limit condition that's sudden, is to make it very gradual as it comes on. And also remember that chassis is tunable on the end model, so you could select the level of engagement you want and then see how you're doing.
Mm-hmm. So part of this year that you guys have introduced the Kona, an EV version of the Kona, and the Nexo, a fuel cell vehicle. Tell us about these cars and where they fit in the plan of Hyundai.
Well, you know, our company has taken the position that, one, we support, our CAFE standards. We'd like more flexibilities that allow individual manufacturers to tune based on their lineup and their customers. But overall, we support CAFE in terms of its achievement. And the question now is how do you create a product lineup that customers will demand, that customers will buy, and that they're affordable? You know, above all else, how do you make them so they fit within the, you know, wallet constraints of our customers? And so the Kona EV is a great example of a product that we really tried to deliver something that was a no-excuse EV. Mm-hmm. One, everybody, you know, if you read the papers, you say everybody wants a CUV, right? And, of course, right now, if you look in the vehicle market, there's really only one choice for a CUV all-electric vehicle, and I believe the starting price is well above $100,000.
Tesla X you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, or X, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we wanted to make something that was affordable for an average consumer, and we wanted something that would have a no-excuse range that could truly displace. We haven't achieved the idea of CAFE until we displace electric vehicles, or ZEV mandate for that matter. So we have to displace electric vehicles. So we have to create a vehicle that truly will do the same things that a gasoline vehicle will do. And at a 258 EPA range, I think it's safe to say that we've gotten to the point now where someone's not going to have range anxiety as the key reason not to buy. The other thing we have to keep in mind with the Kona EV is at least two of our competitors, I think Nissan and Chevy both, you have to pay extra for the onboard charging. We get level 3 charging as standard in the base price of the car. So now you can get 80% charge in 54 minutes. And you can do that over a wide temperature range, which not all of our competitors can do because of the way we preheat and pre-cool the battery.
And what does 80% charge get you in terms of distance?
Well, it's 80% at 258. I have to get my calculator out, but well over 200 miles anyhow. Yeah. Well over 200 miles. And so that's, now we're talking about a reasonable period of time. I can have a cup of coffee and I get real range or I can have a donut and then breakfast, or I could do a little shopping, and I get real range in that period of time, not just a few miles of range. So we tried to really overcome that issue. So we've offered a CUV product at a very affordable price. Basically, we're estimating that that car will come in around $30,000 after the federal tax credit.
Hey, we're getting down to the end of the segment, and I know you're going to have to go because you got to get to the airport, but we got some questions coming in from viewers. And if any of you would like to ask questions, shoot us an email. Send it to viewermail@autoline.tv. We'll also take phone calls, and that number is 620-288-6546. But, Mike, we got a couple of questions on the Santa Cruz pickup truck. Michael Shipley and Isaiah Lopez want to know, how's it progressing? In fact, Michael Shipley says, I don't know how much longer my Sport Track can hold out.
Please give it another oil change. We're working very hard on it. And I think right now we're really trying to wrap up some great innovation in terms of, clever use of space. So I think what we're trying to do is make sure that when that product comes, that it will punch above its weight class. I could say that much.
2020, is that what we're looking at?
Well, a little short of it. I'd say you need at least one more oil change. I'll say that.
Okay. Okay. Mike Flowers wants to know, does Hyundai have plans to make its own carbon fiber?
That's a good question. And I don't know the answer to that, but I'd love to be able to follow up with that on some future session. Okay. But I honestly don't know.
Okay. Diesel Forum wants to know, what about a diesel option on the Santa Fe?
So we've been working on that for a while. It's still, something that we're working on, not ready to make a final announcement yet, but it's something that's in the works.
Interesting.
So you think diesel has a future in the United States for passenger vehicle?
It's what?
It has a future for passenger vehicles versus,
Well, so we, globally, we sell a large volume of diesels. We have a full range of diesels, both in heavy commercial vehicles all the way down to, light vehicles. It's just we haven't announced in the United States yet, a concrete time.
Gotcha. Jay Siegel says, I keep hearing the Genesis brand is going back to Hyundai dealerships. Is this true?
So there's been a lot of back and forth. Obviously, our launch has been a very measured launch, and it's been based on a lot of it has to be sensitive to state franchise law. And so there's been a preference towards many of our Hyundai stores will take on the Genesis franchise. Of course, they have to meet standards that will deliver a premium experience to those customers. So rest assured, whether it's a new store or a Hyundai store that's taking on the Genesis franchise, they're still going to be held to the same standard of premium vehicle treatment.
Mike in San Francisco wants to know, any plans for a full-size SUV about 10 to 12 inches longer than the current Santa Fe?
I will say yes, and watch the news around the 28th of November.
LA Auto Show.
Could be. That's about the time of the LA Auto Show. I'd say stay tuned.
Okay. Let's see. I think that's about it. You guys must have a couple more.
What more can you tell us around the 20th of November? Any hints about what we might be seeing from that vehicle?
Well, to me, a key goal has been to over-deliver in the area of capability. Because when you think about it, a lot of the virtues of SUVs and CUVs is this feeling of extra durability and feeling that I can get home and get to work and get my kids to school and back safely no matter what the weather. And, of course, here we are in Michigan, and we get snow and we get freezing rain and we get a lot of things that challenge, drivers. And so the advantage of CUV or SUV is to try and reduce that feeling of anxiety and traveling and difficult, whether it's weather or road conditions. And so we want to really over-deliver in that area. We also want to deliver the kind of vehicle that has real capability. So I'm a weekend warrior and I want to do something on the weekend that requires some extra capability, that this car can do that. If I want to tow, for example, might be one of those areas. So, and we want to really have a vehicle that truly deliver for an established family. Someone that's versatile, that has a lot of capability in terms of both passenger and cargo space.
Well, this segment has a lot of competition, good competition in it. Highlander, Pilot, Explorer.
Tahoe. Sort of.
So, there's always opportunity to think about.
So how does Hyundai differentiate in this space?
Well, I'll give you an example. It watch small great, children try and get into a third row seat of current three row SUVs. Just watch them. And they're going to, there's some level of struggle, and generally mom or dad has to get out and help them. So there's certainly an area of opportunity where you can make a third row access easier for small children, people that can't move around big, heavy objects. So there's an area of opportunity there. Reconfigurability of seating is a big area of opportunity. Convenience features for second and third row seats is a big area of opportunity. Design, I think, is a big area of opportunity when you think about the products that are out there. There's a lot of Me Too products out there that don't really stand out so well. So I think design is another area where our team is really thinking about leadership. So, and of course, safety is another area. What parent wouldn't want the safest vehicle to take their kids around in? So I think that's another area where there's a potential for excellence. So I do think there's still some low-hanging fruit out there, and we just have to make sure we do a good job on some of the basics that will draw customers to our showroom.
So in 30 minutes, the name, everybody will be looking at their websites, including Autoblog. And
please do.
The name of this new vehicle will be out there. So, you know, I have this question, though, that as you guys are doing this competing with all of these new technologies and things like that, is there space in this category, or is it very crowded? I mean, are you going to have to, as you were saying earlier, that there's a balance that seems to be happening? Is there?
Well, there's really three kinds of customers. There's, you know, loyal customers. Customers are coming back in those showrooms. So we have a lot of customers that bought an old Tucson or an old Santa Fe. They're coming back to market, and they're growing up in their lives. They have more kids, so their kids are getting bigger. But the big market opportunity is conquest. So how do I develop something that will draw customers who may be very happy with their current brands? They have no reason to dislike them. But we have to offer something different or something special that will draw them into our showroom and have them check out our product. And I think that's where a lot of the extra effort has been placed, is how do we ensure that there's this extra thing that's going to say, you know what, I better check this out. It's something that my current model doesn't offer, or the product that my current brand doesn't offer.
Okay, we've got a few more comments and questions that came in real fast. We'll do this rapid fire. Jay Siegel says, you need a hybrid Genesis to compete against the Lexus LS.
Agreed.
Okay, great. Cesar Tavares says, what about a Kona N?
It's a great idea.
Awesome. Okay. Centurion 1973 says, you plan to tell us production numbers for the Kona EV?
You know what? Our top management in our company here in the U.S., as well as our top management in our parent company in Korea, we are very committed for this to be a volume product. And so, you know, obviously we're going to learn as we start selling, you know, in the next couple of months. But, you know, we're committed to bring in what we need to satisfy the market.
Okay. Two-Track Jack wants to know, any plans beyond a manual transmission for the Veloster N and future N models?
Yes.
Okay. And then where would that go? It's jumping around on me here. What's the next car or CUV to get the N name badge?
Well, it's probably, I will tell you this. So N is not just about those high-performance N models like the Veloster N we just launched a couple of weeks ago. It's also about people that have, for example, I'll use Veloster as an example because there'll be more than one model in the future. Some people have Veloster R-Spec or just a standard Veloster, and they may want to add some of the performance parts that are on the N. Well, we're going to help them. So we're going to have a line of performance parts to help build up a base Veloster or an R-Spec Veloster. We're also going to offer parts to upgrade the Veloster N. For example, we'll have track pads, and maybe we'll have some other things that make it more so I could do more sessions per day and not have to worry about thermal management, for example. So right now it's trackable as you could buy it. But if you're going to do a lot of sessions in one day, maybe you want to have harder track pads, for example. So we're going to do those two things right off the bat. So we're going to have some accessory programs to help the lower level cars that aren't N and also help the N make it even achieve a higher level. But we're also going to offer something below that. So we're going to offer a line of vehicles that offer some attributes of N in terms of appearance and performance, but at a lower price point. It'll be called something like N, but not quite. And so we'll offer that really the first part of next year on a model, and you'll hear about that very soon. So it'll be a model that's already on sale here.
Cool. Good stuff, Mike. Thanks for stopping by. We could keep you all show long, but I know that you've got to run. So thanks again for being on.
Thanks for having me. It's a great time to be here.
We're going to take a quick commercial break because we got to let you know about the companies that support this show.
The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry. We create innovative mobility technologies that reduce energy consumption and emissions while improving performance. Our proven track record has made us an industry leader in forward-looking propulsion solutions for combustion, hybrid, and electric vehicles.
Okay, we're back. And as everybody watches the show know, it's time for Dr. Data.
Okay, so, you know, this one will be an incredibly easy one. We're gonna
which means that we're not gonna get it.
No,
right.
This is gonna be simple. We're gonna go back in time and we're gonna look at some cost numbers and then we're gonna come up to date. We're gonna look at the same numbers. So Katie, please bring up the first set of numbers. So the average cost per mile in current sense in 1975. So this is a multiple choice question that I have. So is it 7.4 cents, 14.4 cents, or 26.8 cents?
Back in 75.
Back in 75. And so this is in today's dollars. And in the beautiful picture back there that Katie created. And
yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so when you say cost per mile, does that include depreciation, gas?
It's all in.
So I can tell you right now today, the AAA says it's about 60 cents a mile.
We'll get to today later.
We'll get to that later. But I'm just using today's base to go back to 1975, which is 43 years ago. And I'm going to have to guess it was 7.4 cents.
7.4 cents.
I would also go with that, too. But that's based strictly on the fact that you kind of extrapolated the data for me. So I'll go with 7.4, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Katie, please bring up the answer.
Huh.
Ooh. So that was like failing your SATs right there. You're supposed to go with what's your first instinct, and that was my first instinct.
See?
Yeah. Maybe I should have thought this through more because that's after the first oil crisis, and gasoline prices had taken a big... Remember when gas got to be a dollar a gallon and we were sure that this was the end of the history of the world?
Armageddon.
Yeah.
All right. So, Katie, let's bring up the next set of numbers. So...
59 cents.
59 cents. Greg, what's your first instinct tell you?
59, maybe.
Is that what your first instinct tells you?
So we should let the people know who are listening and not watching.
Okay.
It's 22 cents, 45 cents, or 59 cents.
And notice it's a modern gas station.
Standard Oil did look a little dated in the other one. Yeah. For 75.
That was very, very 75-ish. And so, Katie, the answer is. Bingo, you guys are both right. So this is according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and this is what we're looking at per mile.
See, no, this is a good figure to bring up, too, because as we talk about ride-sharing and autonomous cars and blah, 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 and maybe people will give up owning a car, I believe it's only going to happen if it gets to be a lot cheaper than 59 cents a mile. If it's 59 cents, if it's more than that, hey, I'm just going to keep the car I got. So I think that 59 cents is absolutely critical. Others will tell you the cost per mile is actually way above a dollar per gallon. But I believe that would include parking. So if you live in like New York City or someplace like that and you're paying a fortune for parking, that would drive up your cost per mile.
So actually, I had to write a speech earlier that I gave this week, and Lyft did some analysis of top cities in places like Chicago, for example, because New York is obviously
crazy.
So I discount that, but they basically found that it is cheaper for a person to use Lyft than it is for them to own a car.
Well, yeah, that's what they say. The studies I have seen so far is that Uber and Lyft, the true cost per mile. Now that may not be the cost for you.
Right.
Because they're still subsidizing their drivers mm-hmm. and trying to get market share. But it's about $2 to $3 per mile.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So now if you're talking fully subsidized, there may be some areas, high parking rates and a hassle to own a car, insurance through the roof, like New York City. Maybe. I'm not sure. I'd like to see somebody other than Lyft say, hey, it's cheaper to
right.
use
well,
Lyft than buy a
you
car.
You kind of wonder where, like, the motivation, you don't wonder. The motivation for that study seems to be a little bit in question.
Yeah.
But well, it's telling people, use Lyft, don't use your own
right.
car.
Yeah,
and but, you know, I was reading this, there's a an analyst I was reading this morning that basically suggests that Amazon buy Lyft. And then what Amazon does is it uses the trunks of the Lyft drivers to deliver packages.
With drones?
No, just so your Lyft driver, just the regular guys, right, are
pick up a package, deliver.
Yeah, they go to the Amazon depot, they pick it up, and as they're driving around, that part of their thing is to deliver packages, and so Prime members will be able to get that 2-day delivery, and this becomes very cost effective for Amazon to be able to do that. And I mean, if they got more money than almost anybody but Google, and so talk about subsidizing the cost per mile.
That would help a lot. And I'm sure the drivers would like it because there was a study. In fact, we ran it in Autoline Daily that really took a deep dive and looked at multiple cities of Uber and Lyft drivers. And they make about $13 to $14 an hour on average. Now, some who are driving Uber, what do they call it, XL or something, the more high-end thing.
More like the black car kind of thing.
Yeah, they can make up to $24 an hour. But the average is making about $13-14 an hour. But if you're delivering Amazon packages on top of doing that, I'm sure the drivers would love that.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little curious how that works, though. You know, like you're the Lyft driver, and you've got to take someone to downtown Royal Oak or wherever they might be going.
Right.
But you also have to drop off a package. You know, it's like there must be like a 48-hour window, I guess, where the Lyft driver drops off the package, still is picking up passengers. I mean, it's Amazon. I'm sure they could totally figure it all out.
They're logistics geniuses.
Maybe I'm overthinking this.
Yeah, but speaking of not owning a car, the Wall Street Journal reported this week that Book by Cadillac is going to be coming to a close. And this was their subscription service that they were offering in a few cities, including the aforementioned New York. So what do you guys think about that? I mean, is this the first shoe to drop? I mean, because we have Volvo is doing it. And
very different system.
BMW is doing it. I checked with Lincoln. They're still offering their Canvas service, but very limited. I mean, it's like West LA. I mean,
it's still a pilot program.
So what do you make of that?
Very interestingly, we just had Anders Gustafsson, the head of Volvo Cars USA, in the studio yesterday. And we were asking him the same thing. And the first thing he said is, Care by Volvo, their subscription service, very different than what everyone else is doing. Porsche, Cadillac, other high-end brands are, give us a couple of grand a month, and you can come and take any one of our cars that you want whenever you want. Whereas Volvo's subscription is, no, you're going to pay, $700-$800 a month. It includes everything except the gas. A year later, you can come and upgrade for another or switch to another vehicle if you want, another XC40. And so very different systems. What I've always wondered about the Cadillac, Porsche et al., how do you manage the inventory?
Right.
I mean, you want to tell anybody, come on in. You want an Escalade, you want an ATS, you want whatever. We got them here. So that means you just got cars sitting around, not making any money, depreciating. You're paying insurance and floor planning them, and you're waiting for somebody to show up to you. I always thought that was a logistical nightmare. I didn't know how they were going to figure that out, unless they charged enough money. And the other thing that Anders brought up is damage. You're in New York City. You're driving. They get scratched. They get dinged. They get, he says, that will kill you. And what they have set aside is Volvo has set aside a reserve. And he was a little bit hazy on the money, but let's just call it $1,000, that now they don't have to worry. If the car gets damaged, they've set the money aside already for it.
Okay, so how is what you're talking about different than a lease?
Because it includes insurance and finance, everything. And you're
saying it's like $800 to get this vehicle.
Yes.
So isn't that really high for? I mean, so let's say we're going to lease a XT4.
It does seem pretty steep, and I think part of it too is appealing to maybe a different kind of customer. You know, younger types of buyers or users, as they might be called, would rather use a subscription, even if it's only like, you know, semantically different than a lease. That just might be more appealing.
No, you're absolutely right, Greg. That's what it comes down to. It's somebody who says, I don't want to get a bill for the car. I don't want to get, you know, a monthly bill, you know, monthly payment. I don't want to get my insurance bill. I don't want to, you know, have to worry about me. I don't want to worry about that. Here, $800. Take this away from me, all this worry and angst and time. Yeah, I'll pay a premium for it. Now, that's upper end of the market, right?
Right.
I don't think you're going to see Toyota doing this with Corollas. I don't think that's going to happen at all. But again, what Volvo said is, they're sold out. I mean, theirs is still kind of a pilot program. They only have a few thousand vehicles in the program. But he said, we got to be careful. We can't just go out and let this happen. We got to let it grow organically and make sure that we're delivering top-notch service.
So what happens, I want to know, what happens to these cars after the year?
Yeah.
Okay, because the new model's out.
I shouldn't be giving the show away. This is our AutoLine This Week one. But very interestingly, Volvo believes it can subscribe cars and end up selling them as used for 7 years. So you do your subscription service. Let's say you do the two-year one, and you come back. Now they've got a used car, right? Now they're going to lower the price. And they wouldn't talk. Well, let's say it's $500 a month now. So you can get this very nice XC40, and it's all your insurance and maintenance and everything like that. And then when it comes back a couple of years after that, maybe you lower the, now it's, I don't know, could it be $200 a month? And then maybe you end up selling it as a used vehicle. But he thinks that, I mean, literally, that they could get several two, three customers out of one vehicle.
That really builds some serious brand loyalty, which I think Volvo is already really strong in that area. Their customers come back. A lot of them pay cash for their cars, and they just have this real, like, serious stable of customers who will only buy Volvos, you know, unless they buy a Subaru or something. But, you know, similar groups. I don't know. I also think, too, like, Volvo has really thought this out. It's like a pillar of their strategy. Like, I think they're kind of, in some ways, I wouldn't say betting the house, but they're betting, like, the porch or the backyard that, you know, consumers are going to really do this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why they've, like, their plan has layers. It, you know, it looks at, like, the life of the car and the spectrum of the buyer. And it really goes forward, like, a decade for where, like, the car and where that, like, user could be. Whereas I feel like the Cadillac program was a little more narrow in scope, which is fine. You know, everybody's kind of essentially doing pilot programs. But I also think maybe the Book by Cadillac, as it was called, I keep wanting to call it Book Cadillac, like the hotel in town here. But I think that almost speaks more like Cadillac's kind of trying to really dial down, focus on, you know, revitalizing their lineup, moving from New York to Warren. And they were just like a subscription service. That's not something we're going to do right now. Like, I think that speaks more to their priorities versus subscription services.
So you think subscription services going forward have life?
Yeah. I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And what does this do to dealers? Are they going to be happy?
This is also very interesting. If you're subscribing a car, you're not selling it.
Oh.
You're not leasing it. Guess what? Franchise laws no longer apply.
So it goes back to Greg's semantics.
Yeah.
It's just
One of the things that Volvo was astonished by is how many people signed up for their subscription service on their phone.
Hmm.
Never went to the dealer.
That's interesting.
Except to get the car.
Mm-hmm.
I really feel like that Volvo's ahead of the game on this one. The way they're just, I mean, even Polestar, their sort of performance supercar, whatever you want to call it, brand, they expect a lot of those things to be predominantly sold's not the right word, but consumed by subscriptions. So, yeah.
So here's
wait, we got to take another quick break. I know we got a bunch more things to talk about, but first we're going to give a shout out to our good friends at Lear and Bridgestone.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts,
and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
All right, we're back talking about all things automotive. And in fact, if you want to keep up on everything that we do here on Autoline, check us out on social media. We're at Autoline, at Autoline on Twitter, at Autoline Network on Facebook, and on Instagram. And you can keep up to date with everything that we're doing out there. I'd highly recommend it. Okay, back to you, right, Mr. Vassilash.
So, okay. You know, we heard from Mike O'Brien, and so here we have Hyundai, and Hyundai is going to be coming out with a three-row SUV. They've got a two-row SUV. They've got the Kona. They've got the Veloster. They've got the Sonata. They've got the Elantra, the Santa Cruz. The pickup trucky thing is okay. Full line, right? I mean, this is the direction they're going.
Right.
Okay. So we heard this week from Jim Lenz at Toyota that they may be looking at cutting some vehicles out of their lineup. Okay, we've heard from Ford saying basically that, so far as they're concerned, cars, with the exception of Mustang, are probably not going to be in their future. So my question is to you guys, once upon a time, it seemed that for any car maker to be considered to be a real car maker, they had to have everything. Does that even matter anymore?
Oh, I don't think so. I think that's really like just that old model goes back to like 20, 30 years ago where you thought you had to meet the consumer in every single segment and every single life point. I think a lot of that was perhaps, you know, driven by General Motors because they did that so well for so long. They were world's largest automaker since like, what, 1931 until the early 2000s. And every brand, every purpose, every segment, they owned it in so many different ways, and everybody copied them. And I think now what you're seeing is like, well, you don't have to own every segment, but if you can really own one or two, well, bingo, you know. It's the way to do business.
Two things driving it, as I see. You know, there's way more competition today, so to try and compete against everybody is very expensive. Now they got to put all this money into electrification, autonomy, whatever, and you know, when you have these little niche products, guess what? You don't make money on them. And I was stunned to see Toyota lose so much profitability in North America. You know, this is where they really made a lot of money. They're now just starting getting back to making good money in North America. And I'm sure they're looking at areas where they're not making money, i.e. little niche products. Get rid of them. I mean, put the money where it's really going to make a difference for the company. And I think you're going to see a lot of automakers say, let's stick to, like, to your point, Greg, if we're number one or two in the segment, we're going to stay, the old Jack Walsh thing at GE. You got to be number one or two in your business or get the hell out of there. Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that occurs to me is that shouldn't we be at a point in terms of, you know, this would be a question for Sandy Monroe, of manufacturing capability and flexibility such that low-volume production could be done in a profitable way. Therefore, you could have these outlier cars that you'd say, you know what, we only sell 8,000 a year, but you know what, it's good money.
Look, what's very interesting to me is if you look at all the new EV startups, starting with Tesla, they're all chassis frames. They're body-on-frame. And if you put, you know, everything into the chassis, the powertrain, the steering, you know, everything, the drivetrain and powertrain. And now if you want a longer vehicle, you just extrude longer aluminum side rails. If you want a wider track, you extrude wider cross members. It's so cheap to do. And now all your money goes into the top hat, the body panels. I think that gets you a lot closer to the goal. And if you look at what GM or even Volkswagen have talked about for their electrification strategy, it's exactly the same thing. It's the skateboard, mm-hmm. You know, which Chris Baroni Bird and, right. You know, Larry Burns came up with what, almost two decades ago. I think we're going to see a lot more of that. You know, the industry went with unit body because it's somewhat lighter than a body on frame. But as you start going into aluminum frames, like all the EV startups are doing, you've greatly mitigated the cost difference. And I think, especially if you put the crash structure into the chassis, wow, now you can do top hats. I'm not going to say all day long because you still have to tool them up, but it makes it a whole lot easier to do.
Somebody pointed out to me when I suggested that be the way to go, they go, but what about rollover?
What do you mean, what about rollover?
Well, because it's not in the chassis. So as you flip the car over, so you're going to still have to have those ginormous A-pillars or...
True. For a rollover and even to a degree side impact, you still have to have structure in the body. But for frontal, small overlap, you can just about put it all in the chassis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then you can even do both. I mean, one of the reasons why the Crown Vic was such a great taxi car, it was a unit body on a frame. I mean, it was belt and suspenders. These things lasted forever. They were so over-designed.
So you're mentioning money. BMW really came out with some awfully dire numbers, it seemed to me. And, you know, goes back maybe to this whole issue, as you're saying, of having to invest in autonomy and electrification and so on. I mean, did Albert Biermann get out of there at the right time?
With the right parachute?
Yeah.
I think in their case, you know, you're going to see this, you know, they're an independent car company. They're not a particularly big one on the scale of Volkswagen, General Motors, Toyota, any of the conglomerates. So I think that's where you see them being kind of ripe for consolidation. You know, somebody with deep pockets comes along and, you know, everybody always wants to own a BMW. That's an aspirational purchase. Why not own BMW? I think you're going to see a period of consolidation here in the next, you know, I don't know, 15 years, sort of as these new technologies and new mobility services shake out. I think we're going to probably see one or two OEMs, you know, partner up seriously with somebody else. And I think, I don't know if it'll be a BMW. Maybe this was just a rough quarter. Who knows? But, I mean, they're a relatively small player when you look at the global scope. So I think that kind of leaves companies like that vulnerable.
You know, this goes back to what we were just talking about a minute ago. Does Mini make money? I'll bet it does not.
Oh, I'd agree.
So as you come with this big drop in profits, does the board say, hey, guys, do we really need Mini? BMW does not break out the earnings for Mini, so I can't state for a fact it's losing money. But I'll bet it does.
I bet somebody would buy Mini, too, to go down my further consolidation buying, selling theories. I mean, somebody would buy them.
So do you think the purchaser would be another car company, or would the purchaser be...
I'm thinking investment firm out of, you know, Asian investment firm, Indian investment firm. It'd be sort of like the model of, like, you know, like... benevolent ownership, financial stakes, but then maybe Mini is still like sort of spun off independently, something like that.
But I think if they got rid of Mini, I mean, it would be just a blip on their.
Yeah, I think Mini does so far this year. If I'm going off the top of my head, 250,000 cars. It's like one assembly plant's worth of production. Maybe a little bit more than that for the full year.
And weren't they having Steyr build some of their cars for a while?
They were, yeah.
So you could just go back to Steyr and just say, guys, you know.
Yeah,
You're building those I-paces and E-paces. Just, you know, make some room for.
Jaguar would be a good purchaser, though, for Mini when you think about it. Get a couple of iconic British brands with Land Rover all in the same house.
Yeah, but if BMW can't make money on Mini, Jaguar can't make money on Mini. So, I think we're, you know, right now the car market's doing okay, except that China's slowing down real fast. And Europe is up percentage-wise, but for mass market brands, no one's making money or very little money there. The U.S., maybe things are going to slow down. But what I'm getting at is in another year or two, the whole industry is going to have a come-to-Jesus meeting. And they're going to have to say, like Jim Lentz is saying, hey, we don't need these niche products. I believe a BMW might have to swallow its pride and say no more Mini. I think Mercedes, we know for a fact, has never made a dime on Smart. Why keep it? Get rid of it. I think we're going to see some very painful decisions. We're getting very close, 1 or 2 years, and we're going to see the axe fall.
Well, I mean, don't we? I mean, what's the situation with tariffs that aren't? I mean, isn't this going to become an issue? I mean, or and you know, like so BMW makes its X vehicles in South Carolina, yeah, okay. They export those all over the world, including to China. But if there are huge tariffs on vehicles built here being sent to China, Chinese are going to say, we're not going to buy
those. It's already happened. And I'll bet if we are able to dig into the numbers, that is a reason why BMW's profitability has fallen so much. Because remember, if you build a vehicle in China, you have to do it with a partner. And you have to turn over half the profits to that Chinese partner. If you make BMW SUVs in the United States and ship them to China, you keep all the profit.
Right.
Your partner doesn't get nothing.
Right.
But now, if there is, as there is, a 25% import tariff, and by the way, if it's made in America, another 15% on that. Now it's a 45% import tariff. Yowza.
That's really...
Even the Chinese are going, man, I want this thing, but I can't pay right. that much money for it.
And then plus if BMW is making it with steel or aluminum that they imported, that's additional cost, so they have to raise it.
Yeah.
Why does the government hate BMW? What's going on here?
That must be it.
Well, it's not just BMW. The Mercedes is being right. affected the same way. In right. fact, anybody who's shipping from here to China, like Lincoln and Cadillac as well, they're all getting hurt by it. No, this is a real danger for the industry. You know, it's entirely possible that the Trump administration will follow through with its threats to put a 25% import tariff on all vehicles, excluding for the moment the USMCA, you know, the new NAFTA. Canada and Mexico are going to, it looks like, get in under the wire just in time. But if Trump puts a 25% import tariff on European imported cars, it is going to decimate the European industry.
Hmm. Well, something to look forward to, huh?
Yeah, and ultimately consumers...
I hope it doesn't happen.
Yeah, consumers will lose, you know?
They will, and dealers have their hair on yeah. fire about this, if they have any of those import brands.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You look at these kind of storm clouds, and, you know, these are like the same sort of, like, little mini crises that sort of led up to World War I. You know, I hope we're not on the eve of World War III, but I mean, it's like these little sort of geopolitical skirmishes that really led into, you know, the Armageddon of 1914 and then a very rough 20th century in many ways. Mm-hmm. So it just seems like, you know, as you look at these, like, just like tariffs and different things, you kind of wonder, like, well, hey, was that fight really necessary or was this fight really necessary? And, you know, uncertain times ahead.
Well, you know, the thing that sort of strikes me is that, you know, we've talked about this over the last year or so, that, you know, I mean, there is this anticipation that we're going to hit a plateau and that sales are not going to be continually rising in terms of the auto industry just as a natural sort of...
You mean globally?
No, in the United States.
Well, we've already hit that plateau.
But, I mean, so my point is that, okay, we've hit the plateau, and then if you have, you know, the addition of, you know, all of these extraneous things added to that, I mean... It's going to be very unpleasant.
Well, all the forecasters see, you know, a big slowdown coming in sales. You know, they see we're at probably going to end this year at about 17.4 million. They're saying by 2020 it's under 16 million. So that's it. I think it's going to happen.
16 is still a very robust number, too. I mean, if you look back even a decade ago when, like, we had some really scary SAR numbers.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think this will be a real kind of gut check time, too, for the industry. You know, they had all those really aggressive restructuring plans in bankruptcy, outside of bankruptcy. We'll be profitable at this rate. Well, now it's time to put your money where your mouth is. If, the selling rate's 15, 16... Prove
yeah.
it.
You well, know? You know, look, General Motors just reports a big pop in profits for the third quarter and at the same time announces it's going to offer all these buyouts to get rid of people. Right. Ford has already announced it's going to have these rolling headcount reductions. They're all looking at these forecasts that the market could drop under 16 by 2020. You know, for GM and Ford, North America, the United States, right, is their profit machine. Mm-hmm. So they're already preparing for the downturn.
You know, and we say 2020, and it seems like, oh, the future, 2020.
2019 and like what?
It's almost here.
Right. What am I, 13 months away. Yeah. Hey, G-Man GT wrote in to say they forget, meaning us, I think. The whole reason why OEMs keep small cars around is to lower the fleet MPG average. I think he means raise the fleet MPG average. But this is a misnomer. It's not really correct. In the old days, and that wasn't that far ago, you had to average up all the cars that you sold, and that was your fleet average. And then you did the same for trucks, and trucks had to meet a different number. That's all gone by the wayside. Now you have different footprint classes for cars and different footprint classes for trucks. And all you have to do is meet the target for that footprint. So you could get rid of all your small cars.
Right. Yeah.
The reason they keep them is they want people to come in and buy a small car today and then a few years later come back and buy a bigger one and keep them in the brand for their whole life.
Mm-hmm. I think at some point people may want small cars again. I mean, you know, gas prices go up, uncertainty in the Middle East. You know, who knows what happens? Right. There might be a day when the Ford Focus or the Fiesta. I mean, I remember not that long ago, those were like two pillars of Ford's sort of product blitz and path to salvation. So I could see a day where we're not all, you know, so SUV-centric.
Yeah, and it sort of makes me wonder that you have companies like Hyundai, which would have the Accent, and Honda with the Fit, or, well, Toyota will probably get rid of the Yaris. But, to your point, I mean, If consumers want these things and companies don't have these things, I mean, those that do are going to be smiling that they kept them around.
And that worked out pretty good in 07, 08 for Toyota and, you know, those Fords and Hondas, you know, they were positioned. And then General Motors, Chrysler, I did make those really strong pivots to get their lineups a little bit more in line with the small car demand. And then apparently they really didn't because everybody wants SUVs now.
Right.
Okay, we got two more questions, and we should probably wrap this up. Barry Rector from Indy says, today's the funeral for Mary Holman George, the matriarch of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. You have any thoughts or stories of her?
I don't.
No thoughts or stories.
All I can tell you is, I mean, boy, she has been like an icon at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. She was the one who would say, drivers, start your engines. Right. And it's sad to see that go, but I don't really have any inside stories or anything.
Great life, well lived.
And it's interesting that although I'm sure some people were very skeptical just a few years ago that the Indianapolis 500 would continue to have the same sort of resonance that it does, I think it has come back in a way that I think is unexpected. And the Holman family probably had a lot to do with that.
Yeah. They did. Okay, Dale Leonard from Cleveland wants to know, now that Jim Hall has this Uber position with General Motors, does that eliminate him from ever being on Out of Line After Hours again? I miss the man who knew too much. And, it does. We've done shows at the Dream Cruise where we've been able to bring Jim on because all he had to talk about was classic cars. In his position at GM, he cannot go out and speak his mind about what's going on in the industry, not on a show like this.
Or he would just, being Jim, he is very voluble in terms of his conversation, and he might let things slip that he shouldn't let slip in his enthusiasm.
He might. I think he knows better than to do that. I'd love to get him back on the show again. We will get him back on the show again, but it's we may have to wait until he retires from GM. And then Dale also wants to know, whatever happened to Jason Vines after your review of his book? Seems like he fell off the map. Any chance of getting him back on again? Jason is semi-retired now, and I believe he's living in Virginia. I think he's got a beach house or something like that there. And if he gets back into town and lets us know that he's going to be here, you bet we'd love to get him back on the show.
His book was good. I liked it.
Yeah. He's got multiple books.
Yeah. A lot of stories.
Well, real good. Gary, we got to do this again next week.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's great. Event. Great having you on here, too.
Always fun.
Okay.
Good talking cars.
And want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.